Hello, listeners. Me, oh my. First off, thank you all to you loyal listeners. I seriously am always thinking about how I can make these episodes as intriguing for you as possible. I hope that you have enjoyed the guests that have been on so far and the discussions that have taken place. I come from very humble beginnings, and so even now I live the suburban life. But in the realm of cars and transit, I do have to venture out and be open to hearing how other people think about social issues and how auto companies are developing new products and services. And so wherever you are tuning in to WSCO Weekly, I hope these episodes are making you think more profoundly about our transportation ecosystem or providing you with education so that it empowers you to be at the table to make our entire transportation system more better. I've said this before, but I'm greatly concerned for my parents and other folks who would be like my parents. They are in the sunset years of their life, and I know they still want to do and see so much of this world. And with these new modes of transportation, it is necessary for us to constantly think of new ways to reinvest in our infrastructure, and that is very much a personal issue of mine. And it's what motivates me to continue to deliver these episodes to you. Also, I want to recognize a lot of you, let's say 10 episodes and less listeners. I've given a shout out to you before, to listeners in Short Hills, New Jersey and Clifton, New Jersey, and also listeners in Michigan. So thank you for coming back. And ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the newest batch of listeners in Dublin, Ireland. Seriously, Dublin, Ireland. Thank you for tuning in. That is beautiful. I'll be kicking off a new monthly email in September. And so if you want to have access to more insider information, please visit wscoweeklypod.com and look to sign up for this email list. Let's get right into episode number 88. Episode 88 was a conversational journey, and while the topics that are discussed might seem heavy at times, I want to stress how much you can learn from today's guest. I reflected deeply after recording this episode because I think this is one of those episodes that you may get more out of it by understanding how an entrepreneur thinks. And what's different between an intrapreneur versus an entrepreneur? An intrapreneur is an employee who creates a business operation within the company itself. One of the advantages, you can argue, is that an intrapreneur can capture the creativity and the excitement of an entrepreneur, but have more resources and less risk. So, you will surely absorb some really good nuggets of information on this episode by just understanding how my guest thinks about transportation startup companies and specifically the one that he is managing. So, let's take the car out of park and let's start the show.
You are now tuned in to the WSCO Weekly Experience.
Mabuhay, bienvenidos, vitete, and welcome to WSCO Weekly. On today's show, we have a great guest who's demonstrated some world travels, personally and professionally. We're here in the studio of Nixon Peabody. I'm with my good friend, transportation correspondent, stand-up comic, and muni bond attorney, Mr. Rudy Salo.
It's almost an insult to the word stand-up comic to even say I am a stand-up comic. I'm still in training. I have about 2 or 3 years before I can really say that, Dennis. But, you know, I have been on stage, and I have made at least a couple people laugh that I've paid to laugh. So I guess you can go ahead and say that every once in a while.
Brunch.
Yeah, my jokes are that bad.
Well, look, listeners, I had a pleasant or an interesting experience coming from Orange County up to L.A. today. I took the train, specifically the Amtrak, and as I was working away on the train on about an hour and 15-minute commute, there was a point where we came to a stop, and I was texting away. I kind of lost myself in a text conversation. And at some point when I ended the text conversation, I was like, man, we're at the stop for a pretty long time. Like, where the hell are we? And lo and behold, thank God I paid attention enough, because I was probably 5 seconds away from missing the Los Angeles stop, and my butt would have been heading up to Ventura County.
Well, I'd like to point something out. You were on the train. You were really involved with your work. You were focused. You weren't distracted with driving or parking or any of that wasted time that I always point out that is unnecessary when you're commuting to someplace. Do you now see the benefits of not using a car?
Rudy, for the first and last time, I will say this on the show. You are right.
Thank you. Thank you. It's impossible that it'll be the last time, because I'm always right.
Listeners, let's get on to today's guest here. Today's guest serves as CEO of Next Future Transportation, a robotics and artificial intelligence company that is developing a modular autonomous electric vehicle fleet and the supporting operating system to bring its transportation as a service solution to market at scale. Sven is recognized for creating exponential growth initiatives for both public and private companies. His venture development experience includes supporting entrepreneurs in the process of internationalization, providing privileged access to the most relevant markets, partners, and financing. Previously, Sven served as a venture development partner at Veramonte, an international investment and holding company based in Los Angeles. He was responsible for developing Veramonte's growth strategy, including the development of Formula E, the first FIA-sanctioned all-electric race car series. I'm a big fan of Formula E myself. Prior to joining Veramonte, he spent 12 years in various leadership roles with Siemens and was widely recognized as an intrapreneur for supporting the launch of multiple businesses. As vice president of the Siemens Cities program in North America, Sven was responsible for the organizational development, rollout, and ongoing success of Siemens' strategic initiatives related to cities and infrastructure development. He's a former member of the German swim team. He received a full athletic scholarship to UCLA. Men, women, and children, please welcome to the show, Mr. Sven Hackman.
Hi, Dennis. Hi, Rudy. Thank you so much for having me. Long anticipated, and it's great to be here.
Well, first off, actually, I want to mention, you know, secretly, actually, to me and Rudy here. Rudy, it's a good thing that this is a podcast and not like a live TV show, because certainly Sven's good looks puts us to shame.
Are you intimidated by Sven's looks? Did you know he was a former model?
I mean, he was part of the German swim team, so I think that goes kind of hand in hand.
Isn't that right, Sven? Weren't you a model at some particular time?
That is definitely a part of my early career that I don't like leading with, but that was one of the reasons that I actually immigrated to the States. But actually, on the topic of stand-up comedy, Rudy, I was reminded of a former Volkswagen ad in which a German-speaking stand-up comedian delivered in the same accents that you hear right now, jokes. Cut to: leave comedy to Americans and engineering to Germans.
That's good. I like that. I like that very, very much. So you wouldn't call yourself a comedian then in any way because of your German heritage.
Exactly.
Okay. I mean, yeah. But otherwise, you would do it.
I would do it. I just won't and cannot deliver humor.
Well, so Sven, you're not into stand-up comedy. You have your accent that you've had since what, maybe the last 20 years or so. You picked that one up, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, name is actually Steven, not Sven. That's right.
Well, so what else are you into right now?
Sure. I mean, the topics relating to AI and automation and really the impact on society is of great interest to me personally and professionally.
Interesting.
Yeah, and there are certainly big questions that exist, and much more immediate questions about what AI could mean for, you know, jobs and income, you know, inequality, where, for example, the World Bank reported that nearly 60% of all jobs in developed countries would be subject to automation in the coming years. And so the rapid emergence of AI raises policy and ethical concerns that touch on issues ranging from privacy and transparency to fairness and safety. And so, you know, in that context, I'm not suggesting that I oppose AI. The opposite is true. I work on AI solutions. But certainly, you know, recognize that the way in which AI can augment human capabilities to improve society are almost limitless.
I am also somewhat obsessed with AI, and partially because I'm a science fiction geek. I do a little bit of writing, and AI has always got some component in any of my stories. I'm not 100% sure yet where I'm going to land on the loss of the jobs. Obviously, many jobs that can be replaced by AI, perhaps they should be, but I think AI can actually open up a lot of jobs. I mean, somebody's going to need to repair that AI. Somebody's going to need to direct that AI. Even when you come to the case of autonomous vehicles, whether that's in trucking, I mean, I'm convinced that perhaps robots can do things better and free us up to, you know, really use human potential. That's my hopeful view of AI.
Agreed. And someone recently said that AI can seem dystopian because it's easy to describe existing jobs disappearing than to imagine industries that never existed appearing. And so if you look at, you know, when industrialization killed agriculture jobs that employed almost 3/4 of the population, people dreamt up new ways to keep fellow humans working, right? We crisscrossed the country with highways, we took the skies with flying machines, and built computers. So I believe in you know, the power of human ingenuity, but I am concerned, and I believe that a much more you know, inclusive dialogue needs to occur.
Yeah, I don't think we'd have the societies or the cities that we have today had that industrialization, you know, automation component occur in agriculture. Like, we were able to get out of the fields once we were figured out that, hey, we don't have to spend all of our time working on feeding ourselves. Let's go do some better things. And that's when we had the collection and the birth of our cities. And I, for one, think that that was the advancement of humankind. So I'm excited for the future and excited for the future of my children.
I got to tell you, I got chills down my spine here as I'm listening to you guys talk. I've actually never heard about AI talked about so optimistically.
I'm not as fearsome of the, you know, Skynet taking over. I don't think that AI can ever have a consciousness. You got to believe. That,
why don't you think it would have a consciousness? Isn't that the whole idea and concept of AI?
I don't think so. I think consciousness is the one thing that separates human beings from all other animals and all other quote unquote beings, whether they're artificial beings or not. And whether you think that consciousness came from divine origins, or whether we just created consciousness because of evolution, I don't know. But I think consciousness, true human consciousness, is what separates us from everything else that's out there.
I would agree with that. I would also maybe just add to the fact that when you can put some kind of math behind consciousness and generate lots of data to which now you can create algorithms to, you know, predict what the next action would be, an AI will be able to all of a sudden make hopefully the right action, right? It's not like all human actions, all human responses are always equally positive.
See, I thought perhaps I've spoken about this on this particular podcast. Maybe it was on other podcasts. I don't like math because I can't do it. I'm not smart enough. I don't like numbers. You can't BS math. So no, the reason why we are humans is because there's that feeling component to everything that is, in my opinion, divorced from math. So
Sven, how did you get into this AI thing, right? Even though the topic of AI has probably been around for a while, decades, it's picked up a lot of steam, especially in our worlds of mobility and automotive. But when did you specifically get more into AI?
So it really started with the topic of automation. And even in my days at Siemens, where, you know, we supported the U.S. Postal Service on postal automation or factory automation solutions, I mean, I recognized that automation is world-changing as we recognize it today. But true AI, that exposure came while starting to work with Next Future Transportation, the company that I serve now, where a significant part of what we do in serving society, by the way, is based in algorithms that help optimize, basically traffic and passengers and resources overall. And so with that comes a responsibility to understand what you're working on and also, you know, gain insight and foresight from critics that you need to take to heart if you're building a responsible company that is positioned to serve, you know, communities longer term.
Yeah, if Sven, knowing what I know about Next Future Transportation, Inc., and I've known it for a while and I've been following you guys for a while, I've had the pleasure through here at Nixon Peabody to serve as, outside counsel to the company. I mean, I feel like we see eye to eye to this. I've always made the argument, and I constantly say it, that, you know, for this utopian future of a driverless society, my opinion's always been we got to redo our infrastructure. We got to build everything out. We got to build a 5G network and even more advanced and have everything connected. And a huge component of the connectedness that I see is an artificial intelligence component. Do you think we can ever get to the full potential that Next Future Transportation Inc. could provide without redoing our infrastructure?
So I think even independent of what Next Future Transportation can provide and proposes to provide, imagining a future that is fully autonomous in transportation, which includes passengers and logistics, really needs to be understood in the context of all participants, meaning it's not a challenge of technology. If you look at a micro lab, which is an automated warehouse that has been perfected, or even aviation today, right? I mean, you have participants that all that are all in sync, where the open roads are very difficult to manage, where all participants follow the rules, be it autonomous, semi-autonomously, or a mix of the above. And therein lays the challenge as I see it.
Yeah, and I see that as well. I also argue, as a part of this utopia, that you need to divorce the human drivers away from the autonomous drivers, whether that's through dedicated lanes or designated lanes or something. I do think that the human component, especially somebody that's not, maybe doesn't have the proper infrastructure in the car, that's maybe not connected, would just cause havoc. I feel like that's pretty much what you're saying as well.
Well, let me interject something real quick, Rudy, because I think what's interesting, and again, maybe you can help clarify this, right? Because Rudy, I think in that scenario, it fits absolutely in the city of, let's say, Los Angeles or very developed countries. Whereas with what I understand what Next is doing, you guys are really implementing solutions for these emerging markets. So you actually have the chance to like redefine what the transportation culture is like. So then at that point, do you still need to have these autonomous shuttles be in a dedicated lane if you're creating this transportation society from the ground up already with the premise that autonomous vehicles are part of it?
So
do you follow that, Rudy?
I do. I follow it. I guess I just don't subscribe to that. Understood. So I'd like to hear what Sven has to say.
So since we last talked, Dennis, we as a company have actually looked at the opportunity in a different way, and we came to the conclusion that it should not be the emerging markets where we launch, okay, because of the attractiveness of getting to market faster, potentially with less regulation. But we specifically want to be regulated. We want to become part of the ecosystem of innovators, whether it's self-driving vehicles or technology companies that are being regulated and that are collaborating with governments that are putting a lot of resources into this topic. And so we view the EU and Europe, specifically including Norway and North America, as our primary go-to-market focus. And from there, we believe we are on a solid foundation to grow the company.
On a more granular level then, so in North America or Europe, are there specific, if not cities, what is the common theme of the locations you're looking at to deploy?
Sure. So there are several determining factors that are driven by transit agencies and municipalities faced with significant challenges. You know, just to name a few, if you look at population growth, where current infrastructure is not equipped to deal with the demands of dramatically growing urban populations, you have changing demographics and changing neighborhoods. And frankly, transit agencies can't respond fast enough by building rail lines and digging tunnels. And so you have traffic congestion that continues to be a multi-trillion dollar drain on the global economy. The environment remains a very important topic, both to society, but also to us and other innovators, where, you know, transportation continues an average of, you know, 30% in greenhouse gas emissions. And we know that that can be affected. And that's an area that really can be affected by policies, but also by collaboration between companies like ours and governments. And then you have, you know, the overall infrastructure needs, which I guess relates to the population growth example, where municipalities, you know, are faced with pressing infrastructure upgrades and priorities that compete with some of the more innovative technologies like ours, and simply can't pay for them or, you know, acquire them fast enough in order to evoke solutions. And so our company was established really to serve municipal transit agencies and the population, which we believe is fundamentally different from the recent companies that have emerged, which at times are perceived as being imposing. So they built it and placed it without really developing, you know, the policies and
it's asking for forgiveness than permission.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so specifically, we're looking in our initial deployment and go-to-market for partnerships where we can create commercial prototype fleets in a living lab environment, which has to do with, you know, obviously getting street approval, type approval on the vehicle, but also, you know, addressing concerns, major concerns over safety, satisfying obviously the regulators, passengers, and our insurance companies as well.
So, you know, even though there's going to be a video of Next Transportation, if I understand it correctly, again, these are modular vehicles that can kind of take its own individual journey to pick up, drop off passengers, and then it would reconnect to the fleet of modular vehicles. And then, you know, the way that I would see this is that instead of, let's say, taking the train up here, I could, you know, hail a Next Transportation fleet in my city of Aliso Viejo. It picks me up, it takes me through the city streets, takes me eventually onto the highway, connects me with the rest of the Next fleet, takes me up to LA, and then eventually the pod drops me off here in downtown LA. Is this in the realm of what the concept and eventually the execution is?
Well described. So exactly. So they're individual pods, as we call them. Think about them as square boxes, but really they're vehicles. And what makes us unique is the ability that you described for those pods to connect while in full motion. Once connected, the internal space is utilized like a bus or a light rail. So it opens up. And then our algorithm will reassign you or any other passenger within the connected fleet to a new seat. And that is based on your final destination.
Where to a new seat inside the...
Inside. Okay. So you may go from the back pod to the front pod.
Oh, I see.
Because
I see.
Once we get to the destination, the pods will separate and deliver you closest to your destination, where you may be going to Disney Hall, I'm going to, you know, to the stadium, and so on. And so it's about the optimization of passengers or goods for that matter, thereby reducing the traffic footprint,
right,
congestion drastically.
Well, and plus two, again, just as my experience coming up on the train today, you know, at some point you kind of lose yourself in productivity. And that can happen here as well with your guys' product.
And so while you commute, there's certainly productivity. There is, you know, you can, you know, utilize the space in new and unique ways. And one of the, you know, ways that we envision commuting is that we can deliver services in motion. So imagine you have the same commute every day and you want to, you know, have a coffee. So it's conceivable that the back pod is a coffee Starbucks pod, mm-hmm. and other services. And this is not anecdotal. We've been approached by several, you know, consumer goods companies and solutions providers who have investigated the possibility. With all of that said, I think it's important, you know, to dial back the expectations. For example, the scenario that you described and I confirmed is really an end state, because that is not, again, you know, enabled by technology alone, but by the availability, the support, the legislation of self-driving vehicles. Mm-hmm. And we believe that's still far off. So the way in which we'll go to market is with driver-enabled fleets. So a municipality today has, you know, purchases buses, or, you know, owns, operates, and maintains very expensive buses. Turns out buses are the most underutilized modality, yep. in the municipal transit mix. Mm-hmm. 10% utilization. Maybe packed in the morning during rush hour, in the evening. Otherwise, that bus, whether full or not, follows a rigid route, right? So it's inflexible, and therefore it's very expensive. It's a loss leader. It's subsidized. And so we looked at this 100-year-old modality that hasn't been innovated and said, what if you cut, so to speak, a bus into four pieces, four pods connected equal one bus? What if you gave municipalities the ability to get into electric transit, as most of them are, by mm-hmm. buying, by the way, a $500,000 to $800,000 electric bus as a service. And so we can actually respond to demand and create much more, offer much more flexible services. And that's really the platform that makes it so collaborative. This is not about a company, but really about a platform we've created. Some say like the iPhone for transportation. Right.
Okay.
Where the apps that are created and sit on top, whether it's the Starbucks, right, van, or the Brinks truck, or
I see. Interesting. If I wanted to quote unquote sponsor a pod, like for instance, I'm almost thinking of this in the context of if you go to a Staples Arena, you get a suite. Well, I can buy a suite there, and that'll be my suite. I envision this is what could happen also with these pods, where if I were to develop my own app, I were to develop a business around, you know, transporting people or goods, I could use that on your platform.
That's correct. And again, mm-hmm. it's not anecdotal. There are quite a variety of companies that have approached us with solutions that we sometimes question. There's one of the largest, for example, makeup companies in the world said, do you recognize how many professional women do their makeup while driving to work?
Oh, that's interesting.
Which equals texting. What if we delivered those services on the way to work, and maybe, you know, other services at the return? There's been a gym that suggested one could
gym.
A gym. You know, you could do spinning in a pod on your way home.
Oh, my
so
Lord.
Some of this gets very
esoteric.
What are
some of the other ideas that have come out of that?
So we've had a very large and recognized home rental company that
okay.
hired someone that's now managing transportation inquire what a connected fleet may look like. Mm-hmm. Just imagine one pod having two beds and another pod being the bathroom. And so again, these are all interesting solutions and future use cases, but that's not our primary focus right now. We're very basic. We're very focused on providing municipal services, and by the way, collaborating with transit operators, with the workforce and communities to really provide what's right and what's needed.
Well, and so part of this too, Sven, is that, you know, I don't, you tell me, how long have you been into this type of mobility space? Like for me, you know, I started out in the automotive industry probably about 8 years ago, and that kind of spun off into getting into more of mobility, transportation topics. I know you worked at Siemens for quite a while, but were you also specifically already doing things in this mobility space?
So at Siemens, and when we launched the Cities program, really as a test to see if, you know, one can serve cities in a more and unique unique way. The topic of electric mobility emerged and became, a hot topic. And with that, and with the, renewable energy space growing, there was a lot of excitement. But we also looked at hubs, so where places where people and goods converge. And so the topic has always been of great interest to me, and I've been involved, but not to the extent that I am now working with innovators and startups that are billion-dollar valued, or actually billion-dollar companies in a very short time. You mentioned 8 years ago you got involved in this space. I mean, 7 years ago, Lyft started under a different name. Mm-hmm. And if we believe that there's a seven-year cycle for a company to take off, I believe it's becoming more and more compressed. And I also believe that it's in future not just about one company, but really about a circle of influence, a consortium that will offer value.
Let's pivot here real quick. Part of where my interest lies in your work is that as part of Next Transportation, I think have the privilege of traveling to lots of different countries to experience what it's like in their cultures, their societies, their economic conditions, to see what the response is of connected autonomous vehicles. Can you maybe share some of your travels and what those conversations have been like?
Yeah, be happy to. So Next actually started in Italy to innovators that looked from the outside in, and I met them when they started scaling into Silicon Valley to raise capital and grow the business. But as we quickly found out, Silicon Valley was not the type of environment that was able to support a very complex and ambitious proposal that we presented at the time. And so
that seems like a bold statement, that Silicon Valley wasn't able to take this bold, complex product that you guys had.
Yeah, and I think you have to get a holistic idea of what Next really entails. Mm. I mean, even the video that Sven will show will only give you a taste of it. Mm. I mean, what he's talking about is honestly a corollary of what I've been speaking to for a very, very long time, which is you have a company like Next that wants to build these, let's just call them transportation pods. They can just work on their own, but to reach their maximum potential, you need to redo a lot of things. Uh-huh. You need to redo the infrastructure. You need to redo your traditional way of doing transportation. You need to redo the way that you think. You need to transform a lot. Silicon Valley, is the place of disruptors. Yeah, I mean, they're
disruptors on the technology end, but that's not enough. Like, you need more pieces of the puzzle.
Correct. Okay. And government buy-in as well. Yeah, okay. You're not going to make a super quick buck off of something like Next. It's a long-term play. Is that correct, Sven?
Rudy, you're right on. And what we encountered was exactly that. Silicon Valley is not a place, but many communities and many city councils. And quite frankly, as an entrepreneur, oftentimes defined by venture capital and, that ecosystem. But what we really sought and what we then found by coincidence was Dubai and the ruler of Dubai, His Highness Sheikh Al Maktoum, putting out a global vision really to attract the world's most innovative transportation solutions. 3,000 applicants, two startups were selected, and that was Hyperloop One out of Los Angeles and
you guys.
Us.
Oh, wow.
And that was really what we required, a top-down commitment, and I would say a commitment that probably could only exist in a place like Dubai or in China at the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Let me back up what he's saying right there. And we recently just discussed this on the podcast that you released today with Avery and Inrix. Remember when I brought up the whole point of the patchwork you have your local cities, you got 88 cities in LA County, you got your state government, you got your federal government. That is a mess. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's so hard to do massive transformative changes when you have all these people and all these constituents and all these players with their hands in the pot. Whereas a place like Dubai, it's just one person that could set the policy and just say, do it. A place like China, same thing. Singapore. So that's the difference between the United States and our government structure versus other places. So I like to bring that up a lot, because everyone always says, oh, they're doing this over there and they're doing this over there. Why can't we get there? Well, because we get the benefit of living in a society that we all have a say in. And that's, you know, the great democracy that we live in.
Well put. And I mean, that was the experience that exposed us to the Dubai Roads and Transit Authority, where we had the opportunity to sit down on a daily basis for 6 months and really model around the opportunity. And of course, you know, supported by the vision of the leader, who is spending tremendous amounts of resources to showcase his country, quite frankly, at Expo 2020, which is going to attract 20 million visitors within 6 months, the World Fair, basically. And so that was a tremendous opportunity, and we started growing from there, where within a year we had built a functioning prototype, which we introduced at the World Government Summit a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought us tremendous visibility. And we're now at a point where we could certainly activate a small project in that part of the world. But as I mentioned earlier, equally as important as getting the technology right is to really overcome the difficult part, which is aligning with legislators,
right,
really being regulated and understood. And that is probably best accomplished in Europe at this point, and in North America, in the U.S. And so we're looking at a couple of first pilot projects in Northern Europe, and working with regulators and with other partners as well.
But would you foresee it would be as maybe not easy, because Dubai did have a contest per se, whereas now you're going the route of, you know, asking for permission here, which I imagine would elongate the process of being considered in some of these European cities?
Yeah, because the GCC, the Gulf region, actually looks at European and North American regulation very closely and oftentimes follows it. And so for us to make that investment is not just important, but it also offers the confidence to investors that want to understand that there is a real market and that we have type approval and roadworthiness. And from all of that, obviously, all the other considerations flow, whether it's insurers that need to know that, we've gone through the process, leasing companies and financing companies that enable the network. And frankly, many of the other innovators, whether it's self-driving technology providers that we will integrate, which actually brings me to, you know, the topic of how do we build it. So we have patents on the platform, and we've innovated and built a lot. But the idea here is not to, recreate some of the, you know, leading technologies that we can integrate, but really, working with an ecosystem of partners. On the construction or manufacturing of the vehicle, we don't envision building vehicles on our own. Very expensive, as we've seen with Tesla and many of the other automotive companies, will outsource that to a contract manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So then it really becomes a subscription model,
mm-hmm,
that ultimately, you know, allows many to participate, and we will be one of them.
So let's talk about then another part of these cultures of cities and countries that you have either experienced yourself as a part of Next or just personally. I mean, so you talked about how Dubai, from the top down, was advocating for just a different transportation future, which is allowing Next to be part of that now. You know, maybe let's speak to the education, because I know that for you, you came here from Germany on a scholarship to attend UCLA, which I imagine you were swimming at UCLA then too?
Correct.
And so I know that you've been public and have advocated on German's educational system. Can you maybe elaborate on either the benefit or, you know, what you see as why the German education system is a good model to follow?
Yeah, it starts in public schools, where, you know, there's always been a strong emphasis on STEM and continues to be. And I think that has paid off for Germany as a technology and engineering nation. over the years. But when it comes to university or the higher, you know, higher education, not everyone needs to go to the equivalent of, you know, a junior college or college, as many aspire to here. Actually, in Germany, it's, you know, going to a job skills
technical college,
exactly, is a path that is not only that recognized, but is also highly desired. In other words, once you learn a skill or a craft, you become part of a tradition that is highly recognized and compensated. And by the way, many of those that start there become entrepreneurs, and that really creates the backbone, right, of Germany. It's not the big corporations, but it's that, you know, it's that engineering, private companies, SMEs that continue to contribute.
And they're not going into between a quarter million or a half a million dollar in million dollars in debt to, when they start off their careers. They've got a certification. They probably got to get hooked up with a job, hooked up with a company, and they're starting to build a nest egg. They're starting in the black rather than in the red. Whereas here in the United States, you know, you read these constant stories, you read these constant reports about you have to have a 4-year degree or a 2-year degree, or else your earnings potential is going to be very, very low. So you got to maximize your spending to go to college, and you come out and you're like massively in debt, and you're spending the rest of your life trying to get up to the black rather than being in the red. And I've said this before. I've said this on one of our podcasts here on the Wisco Weekly, and I say this publicly. I do think that the future of education in the United States it needs to change. And I do think podcasts are a big part of the future of education. I do think that the internet is a big part of the future of education. Obviously, the big Ivy Leagues and the traditional schools are always going to be there. I'm a big proponent of junior colleges, but I love hearing about the vocational schools. I love hearing that Germany advocates for that. And I think that we could really take a lesson from you guys here in the United States.
So when Angela Merkel accepted a million refugees from Syria, she was criticized. But really, if you sort of look at Germany, Germany's biggest challenges that lay ahead, because of the aging of the population, there's going to be a tremendous shortfall of workers, and specifically knowledge workers. So by accepting those refugees, who, by the way, came from a country that has a pretty good educational system, they're not people that weren't exposed to education in the past, as in STEM skills, Germany immediately placed young men in particular into jobs, coding classes, and that has already started to pay off. And obviously there was the industry and the employers that committed and really made a commitment to finding work opportunities and really working with those that didn't speak the language, which seemed, as outside of the culture, you know, the biggest challenge. It turns out it's benefiting Germany, and it's obviously not a simple, you know, a simple solution, but one that is absolutely the foundation of any competitive nation.
As somebody who has family from the Middle East, that's fantastic to hear. I love to hear that approach. If you give somebody a job, you give them something to do, then they won't be bored and turn to, extremisms,
drugs.
or religion sometimes can be the replacement of drugs.
Yeah, right,
I mean, it's
right.
one or the other. If you can't get drugs, you go the other side. It's just, that's great to hear. I love to hear that.
At the same time, there's also a contract that you as an employee make with a company that you will continue to take advantage of all the programs, such as the ones that Rudy, you know, outlined, that are available to you to educate yourself, not because it's imposed on you, but there's much more of a consciousness and understanding that, you know, the workplace is changing, industries are changing and shifting, and that you need to continue to gain new skills so that you remain relevant and competitive as an individual. And so I think that's also a shift. It's not just what do you know today and is there a fit, but what have you done to invest into your knowledge base?
I could have been a German. You want to know why? Because the reason why I did the stand-up comedy, the reason why I've done the improv classes, the reasons why I started podcasting, the reason why I started to do everything, I was like, damn, you know, someday just being a muni bond lawyer is going to shoot me in the butt. Like I'm gonna be really, really, really in trouble if that's the only skill I have. I really need to maximize on this future potential. So, I mean, it's just a beautiful way to round about how we started talking about me becoming a stand-up. It comes down to maximizing skills.
Okay. Sven, I have one last question here for you, sir. you as CEO, and this is kind of an extension of what we're talking about in terms of education, but I think this is actually going to be sage advice for our listeners. So you as CEO of Next Transportation and doing what you're doing, you know, what would you advocate for aspiring employees or for graduates who are looking to get into Next Transportation? I mean, if you were to look at your model entry-level employee, what would you advocate for them to do, to study, to get involved in, to learn about?
Great question, Dennis. I must say that was one of the, I mean, I love that question, Sven. I can't wait to hear what your answer is.
So I think there are two perspectives around startups, and that's where I am right now. I also bring corporate experience, but around startups, I would say just find an opportunity and expose yourself to something that interests you. Understand whether that environment is for you, understand the dynamics of the startup culture, and really how you can contribute. Initially, it's not about finding the job and, you know, going on a journey that's going to define your life, but it's becoming part of an ecosystem, part of, you know, this new world, the job, and really learning while on the job. And I think that will teach you just directionally, you know, where you want to go, what kind of functions and experience you want to have as a young professional. Now, in looking at the corporate route, I think I would evaluate a company, and maybe based on an initial apprenticeship, that has a deep investment in me, in the next generation of workers. Where corporations have a tough time sometimes to make the cultural shift, many have invested, but that's very important. So if you were to enter into a corporate environment, I would evaluate again, not necessarily the job itself, but really the support network, the commitment that company has to new and young employees overall. Because that is really a question then of, you know, your experience that will define really your path later on.
Sage. I mean, like, look, it's a different, I wouldn't say it's entirely different other than I like the opportunity part about it. If you are starting out, right, it's not the traditional, hey, I just graduated from college, let me go find any kind of job. Like, you're actually asking somebody to put themselves in a, you know, in a tough situation and let them figure out on their own how they get out of it, and then take that experience and communicate that and tell the employer that, hey, look, this is what I've been through. I traveled around the world by myself, didn't have a dime to my name, but I made it work. And so now I'm at your company Next, and I want to help you guys build out your transportation system because I have demonstrated these types of these skills, these experiences. And it would be beneficial to you guys.
And I think just perspective, right? I mean, I would advise anyone, including my 23-year-old daughter who graduated from Berkeley, to really follow your passion. If it's not about making money. You can monetize what you're doing and you will get paid. But if you can truly follow your passion, you really arrive at a point where you're free. And just to use the German analogy, so a lot of words in Germany have dual meanings. And the word for work is Beruf. But that word, the other meaning, can also be your calling in life. So just imagine you made your calling in life, your passion, your job. Turns out you'll never go to work again or to that thing that you don't want to wake up for on Monday morning.
And piggybacking on what Sven was saying about the experience and getting the knowledge as a college, either a college student or a college graduate, one thing that I've been recommending to, I also teach at law school now, a class once a year. One thing I've been recommending to like law students, which I think is applicable to anybody that's out there, if you're thinking about a particular industry or you're thinking about a particular practice area, or you're thinking about, hey, I think I might be passionate about that, you know what you should do? You should take some money or you should reach out to the conference and say, hey, I'm a student. Can I get a student pass to this conference? I want to get to know the people that are involved in the industry. A lot of time you might think that a particular industry is attractive or sexy, but if you don't go and experience the people that are involved there, you're never going to really know if it's right for you. So you got to spend a lot of time getting to know the industry by going to conferences, by getting involved with groups, and taking and spending that time to find yourself and to see if you fit in there. That's something that I've been recommending to a lot of young people when they ask me for advice.
Well, good stuff. Listeners, be sure you check out the episode page. I'll again have that video of Next Transportation. They're doing some really, really cool things. Sven, thank you very much, sir.
Really much appreciate it, and look forward to continuing the good collaboration.
As we end every episode, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salud, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, nastarovie, to the customer experience.